The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Before I call the case, I want to know how to pronounce the names. So if you could tell me, is it Xiaoyang Sun or?
Xiaoyang Sun.
Xiaoyang Sun. Thank you. And Kyung Yang?
I have generally pronounced it Qing, Your Honor.
Qing Yang?
Oh, yes.
Okay, great. Very good. Thank you very much. All right. So the first case on our calendar, we have four cases for oral argument today. And the first oral argument is yours, which is A21-0177 in the consolidated case of A21-0178 in the matter of Xiaoyang Sun versus King Yang, and the reverse of that in the matter of King Yang, minor children versus Xiaoyang Sun. Okay, counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary or principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And if you could please state your name and the party you represent for the record when you begin your argument. We are ready to go with counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Edward R. Shaw, representing Qing Yang. And this matter concerns an appeal from post-trial motions following order for protection hearings on cross-order for protections requested by both parties. And as the court knows, the trial court ruled obviously against appellant in both actions, leading to the post-trial motions and this appeal. The primary issue on this appeal for appellant is the trial court's denial of allowing appellant to introduce new evidence obtained from electronic storage device recovery that was not available prior to the hearing. And that issue was raised in the, obviously in the post-trial motions, and then is an issue in this appeal. And yeah, new evidence can be considered when a motion to amend findings is combined with a new trial, as was the case with appellant's post-trial motions. And, you know, the test, the analysis essentially is that the trial court needs to make a finding as to whether the evidence was newly discovered. That was not done in this case. That finding, that analysis was not conducted. That there wasn't a finding made either way by the trial court. And as a result, the new evidence was not considered. And yeah, that is significant because the new evidence was likely to affect the outcome of the case. And I did cite a case in our memorandum, which is old but still good law, Sorensen v. Pompadour Incorporated. And that was a case where new evidence in the form of X-ray films was discovered after the hearing. The case was not clear as to why it was discovered after the hearing. It seems like the X-rays were known before the hearing, but for whatever reason, some of the films were not discovered or presented until afterwards. And the finding was that the party should be able to present that new evidence, the additional information on the X-ray films. And that's a similar situation as this case.
If I may interrupt, just if you could address, please, was that an OFP, order for protection case?
That was not. It predates the Domestic Abuse Act. It was a workers' compensation case, but involved a similar issue involving new evidence, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. And you then are challenging the district court's, it sounds like, denial of the order denying the district court's order denying a new trial. How do you square your argument here, asking us to reverse that with our special term determination that that's not an appealable order?
Thank you, Your Honor. Our concern is that the new evidence was not considered, that appellant was not allowed to present and consider new evidence. And that's what we believe is a separate issue. We weren't just asking for a new trial on the same evidence, but that the new evidence was not considered. The district court did not make the proper analysis concerning the new evidence and whether it existed at the whether it was, you know, should properly be considered and would impact the outcome.
And Mr. Shaw, I'm not sure, at least to my satisfaction, you answered Judge Smith's question. If we're not reviewing the motion for a new trial, which is based on the new evidence that you're now arguing should have been received, I'm not sure I understand how we'd be reviewing the argument regarding new evidence if we're only reviewing the original order of protection. Wouldn't we then be just simply left with whether there's a sufficiency of evidence and credibility findings of the court in issuing the order and denying your client's order?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I think those issues would certainly be before the court. I would agree, but I think that the issue of new evidence can be considered even if the issue of the denial of a request for a new trial is not before the court. I think that still can be considered. I think it does go to the sufficiency of the evidence, Your Honor.
So are you referring to, and did your client make an offer of proof sufficiently for our review of the record from the original trial or evidentiary hearing regarding this evidence?
An offer of proof was not made at the original trial or evidentiary hearing, but it was made in connection with appellant's post-trial motions. Appellant did make an offer of proof as to what the new evidence was and how it was significant and how it would contradict respondents' claims and support appellant's claims. So I believe that offer of proof, you know, was made in the record, but it was made in connection with the post-trial filings. It wasn't made at the initial trial because appellant was not aware of the evidence at that time. And I hope that, you know, answers the court's question, and that is certainly a very good question. And, you know, I think the issue of the new evidence is significant because appellant didn't have access to that evidence at the time of the initial trial. It was material that was retrieved from an electronic device that was damaged, that took some time to retrieve. He had to hire apparently an expert of some kind to do that, so it was not available at the time of the initial trial. But it was relevant. It does support appellant's claims, and it does contradict respondents' allegations. And, you know, the district court should have done a proper analysis of the new evidence, looked at whether it was newly discovered, whether it was material, whether it would impact the outcome of the matter. And our concern is that the district court did not do that. And then looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, you know, the issue that the court raised a moment ago, and certainly that's reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard. And obviously it's done and looking at in the light most favorable to the district court's findings. And, you know, our appellant's concern on that is that the new evidence would have contradicted appellant respondent's claims, would have contradicted the picture that respondent painted of appellant, that he was an abusive and controlling person. There had been a pattern of years of abuse, that the new evidence would have contradicted that. It would have, you know, certainly cast that in a different light. And it would have been relevant not just to the granting of respondent's order for protection against appellant, but also the dismissal of appellant's order for protection, as the two matters were related and did turn on the same evidence. Another concern that we have is that the district court erred in its findings with regards to custody and parenting time, and no findings were made that appellant was unsafe to be around the children. No specific best interest finding was made regarding restricting access of the children to appellant, and it's certainly concerning, especially as it gets into issues of, you know, language and cultural upbringing, not allowing appellant to speak Mandarin Chinese, the native language of himself and the children, is certainly deeply concerning. And there weren't the proper findings to justify that kind of a restriction, which certainly goes to appellant and the children's, you know, language and culture and heritage, which makes it especially concerning. And appellant is requesting that the decision of the district court, you know, be reversed, as I believe the evidence does not support the district court's findings. And most important, that appellant be allowed to have the new evidence considered, is that certainly is very germane to the issues presented in both matters, both orders for protection, and the district court did not do the proper analysis, and that evidence would have had an impact on both matters, and that should have been allowed to be presented by appellant and should have been considered. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I represent Xiaoyan Sun, the respondent in this matter, and also a victim of domestic violence. Your Honors, it's no coincidence, quite frankly, I think that we are here today and in this month, as October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It's an important month. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, nearly 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner in the United States. That equates to more than 10 million victims per year. And according to the Center for Disease Control, it's a serious, preventable public health problem, and that one in four women experience some form of intimate partner violence. Now, the law, specifically in Minnesota, includes protections for victims of domestic violence. And one of those protections is an order for protection under Chapter 518B, which is why we are here today. Now, Your Honors, on October 9th, 2020, after five very long days of an OFP evidentiary hearing, there were multiple witnesses who testified, multiple exhibits were presented and received by the court. The court awarded Ms. Sun an order for protection specifically found that there were multiple instances of domestic violence, both physical abuse as well as actions that were intended to cause fear of harm. In addition, the court also made findings that there were additional concerning coercive and controlling behaviors by the appellant. That same day, the court denied Mr. Yang's, quite frankly, retaliatory order for protection and dismissed it. Then on November 9th, Mr. Yang filed what I still deem to be improper motions, which were summarily denied by the court. And now we are here on appeal. Your Honor, I did, I think, provide quite a lengthy brief, but if I could just kind of touch on a few points here, and of course, if there are questions as well.
Could you begin, counsel, if you don't mind, with sort of the latter part of opposing counsel's argument, which deals with the findings, the sufficiency of the findings and the evidence. I'm interested in both the findings and the evidence supporting the determinations relative to the children, the safety and best interests.
Absolutely. And thank you for, and so I just want to make sure I'm clear in understanding your question. You're asking specifically, let me back up here. Are you asking as to the October 9th order or the December orders? I just want to make sure I'm touching on whichever one specifically the court would like me to be going to.
The order for protection itself.
The order for protection.
Not the order denying. New trial.
All right. So, Your Honor, in here, the court did outline looking at paragraph findings of fact, paragraph 4, where it then goes through. There are multiple paragraphs here. So not only, Your Honor, would I also highlight to the court that in the findings, the court, as I already touched on, made a finding that there were these additional concerning and coercive behavior. It's in fact finding of fact 4A8, in which the court specifically noted a concern regarding the party's ability to co-parent. So that right there, Your Honor, is also another one. The court made findings in paragraph number 12 that the court found to be credible, where it was noted that respondent had told the children in Chinese that their mother is a lying murderer, and that there was also concern that the respondent had told the children to lie to police about respondent's actions on April 22nd. And so she had concern that he would continue to use that kind of communication if left unsupervised. She was also concerned that if allowed to speak in Chinese, that that would create additional issues for these children. And then, Your Honor, quite frankly, in paragraph 13, the court specifically found that for the safety of petitioner And pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518B.01 Subdivision 6, the court found that it was in the best interest of the children that respondents' parenting time be supervised with a private supervisor, and that specifically the supervisor not speak Chinese. And I think what's also important to understand here is that
the supervisor, if the supervisor does not speak Chinese, that father cannot speak Chinese.
I apologize. I was reading that too quickly. And so, Your Honor, I think what's also not highlighted here is that throughout the course of this case at multiple hearings, appellant asked to allow for different supervisors, asked to be allowed to speak in Chinese to the children, and the court specifically denied that. And I understand that the December orders are actually not on appeal here before the court. However, in that, the court actually specifically noted that it had denied the request on three separate occasions. This was a matter that was continually re-raised over and over and over again. And the courts continued to make findings that this was simply not in the best interest of the children, that the court had significant concerns about Mr. Yang's intentions, as well as what he was intending to do if allowed to speak to the children in Chinese, and if he was allowed to have unsupervised parenting time. And so I do believe that the court at multiple points throughout this proceeding, when the issue was raised, re-raised, and re-raised, continued to address those issues, continue to consider how they impacted the safety of, quite frankly, the petitioner, who was my client, as well as the safety of the children. The primary...
Can I ask, Counsel, just in a... maybe I don't understand the... proceedings and what happened here. And what is it in this OFP, these OFP proceedings, where were the multiple opportunities that the district court addressed speaking Chinese?
Your Honor, they happened at various hearings, and I believe they are in orders that are not actually before the court on appeal. And I apologize, I just didn't have that.
Okay. So hearings in this order for protection matter.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that it was the language at the end. I mean, what we're looking at is an order that precludes the use of I think it's Mandarin when the supervisor doesn't speak. In other words, I presume to let the supervisor adequately supervise the parenting time to be able to understand what's being said. And I'm just interested, are you saying that there was previous bars outside of supervision on the use of Mandarin?
Yes, Your Honor, because the parties had ongoing, according to, I believe it was and just to sort of back up procedurally here, the original order was issued, and I believe it was in April of 2020. The parties then appeared in the beginning of May for the initial hearing on this matter. Just sort of to give some background here, the way that Ramsey County does these is that the parties appear for an initial hearing, and then if it needs to be set for an evidentiary hearing, it's set. And so at that initial hearing, the parties reached some temporary agreements that there would be some Skype calls as well as supervised parenting time. And then from there, there was this ongoing issue of allowing Mr. Yang to speak to the children in Chinese. And I understand this concern is being raised, and I can definitely appreciate sort of from a cultural perspective why maybe there's this making sure that in essence, this is culturally appropriate. However, the number one concern in an order for protection is the safety of the victim as well as any safety concerns regarding the children. And so the court throughout the course of this very lengthy case and multiple hearings had the opportunity to observe the behavior of the Mr. Yang, as well as to observe any requests for this type of information, and made the determination that it was not in the children's best interest, not in their best interest for the safety, not only of my client, but also the children, that he not be allowed to speak in Mandarin Chinese unless there was a supervisor who also happened to speak Chinese. But the court also explicitly found that it was in for the children's safety, best that this parenting time occur at a supervised safety center. And so,
I appreciate that. And that's, I guess my last, and I won't belabor this anymore. I've already belabored it perhaps too much, but does mom speak Mandarin?
Yes, she does, Ron.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
And so, and the concern, Your Honor, I just actually would like to also go back to that really quick. Your Honor, that concern also came in. Yes, my client speaks Mandarin. However, the concern came in that then during the course of the proceeding, Mr. Yang disputed his own translations from Mandarin into English. And so my client highlighted in her responsive affidavit, for example, to the motion for new trial, that the concern was throughout the course of the proceeding, Mr. Yang would insist that he had to speak in Mandarin, but then dispute what his own interpretation was. In fact, the parties agreed to use Mr. Yang's translations of Mandarin texts that he then later said were incorrect. And that's actually one of the credibility findings that the court made in dismissing Mr. Yang's order for protection, that the court simply just did not find him to be credible and did not find him to be credible in how he would even interpret. And so, again, that just, it started to create too many issues. And the court, quite frankly, was just in the best possible place to observe that behavior and to make those determinations. So then if I could just touch sort of, I realize my time is running low. Here, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals in its March 2nd order specifically concluded, and this is still based on good law, according to Steves, that while appellant may have filed the post-trial motions, that those motions are not in and of themselves, those orders are not appealable. And so what that leaves us with today is the only issue that can actually be before this court, other than I realize that respondent is still raising an issue of jurisdiction. But if we look just directly at the court's order granting my client an order for protection and the order dismissing the order, Mr. Yang's order for protection, it's quite frankly just simply clear that appellant is not happy with the order. The court, as I've already highlighted, had 5 days to view the parties, during which, quite frankly, appellant made no complaints about the interpretation of the proceeding, which is a point that was raised in appellant's brief, and that somehow there was this issue with interpretation when it came to dates. And again, Your Honor, I think that even goes to some of this duplicative behavior that was observed by the court, because during the trial, and it's actually noted in the court's own order, that Mr. Yang's argument was that I was somehow mistaken, that I somehow misheard him. So at the hearing, it was that it was somehow an error on my part. Now in the brief, it is somehow an error on the part of the interpreter. And I would just like to note that was never raised at the district court level, that there was any sort of deficiency with the interpreter. In fact, the court had 2 Mandarin Chinese interpreters available who would alternate from time to time. I don't know how much more protection there can be in that respect.
Ms. Dawson, can I interrupt you? You made one point, and I noticed this in your brief too, about respondent raises a question of jurisdiction. Are you referring to the argument you made in the brief that this court does not have jurisdiction to consider the consolidated appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. The argument is that because the post-trial motions were not proper motions, they could not toll the timeline. And that based on when we're looking at Madsen, that these motions have to have been proper. And in fact, if you review even...
Can I just... maybe the question wasn't quite complete. What I'm trying to get at is, do you agree, though, with the question that I think Judge Smith was asking Mr. Shaw, and I followed up with it, that we aren't addressing those post-trial motions. And if we're not addressing those, then we don't address an issue. We don't have a jurisdictional issue because the special term has already accepted consolidation of the merits review of the original order for protection order and the denial of appellant's order. So that's our sole issue. So we don't, you're satisfied with that, I assume, and there'd be no issue for us to address regarding jurisdiction.
Your Honor, respondent still contends that there is no jurisdiction and that when looking at Madsen, what was not analyzed in the special term order was that these motions have to be, they actually have to be proper. They have to be proper motions. And when you look at the motions, and just to be sort of specific here, when you look at those specific motions, and so for example, I have up here the motion that was filed. For example, the appellant is using language such as setting aside. there's no function in the rules to set aside any sort of finding of fact. Then when you're looking at the motion for a new trial, even by his own affidavit, appellant alleges he had this material in his possession the entire time. This is not newly discovered evidence. And so that's an issue. And so, Your Honor, the argument is that they were not proper motions and therefore did not toll the time period. However, I understand there's the special term order. I think our concern was that still did not fully address what is actually required by Madsen. But I do agree with the special term order, and I think the special term order is very, very clear that and on page 2, that the December 11, 2020 orders are not appealable under the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure. And I ran out of time. I apologize.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Not to belabor the special term issue, but the post-trial motions were heard by the trial court. Obviously, if the trial court believed they were at least proper enough to warrant a hearing and a decision, and then the special term also, found that they were properly before the court. So I think at some point there's res judicata on that issue, to the extent that the special term of the court of appeals had already considered the issue and, found that the motions were proper. I think to quote on page 5 towards the end of the order, the November 9th, 2020 motions were proper motions under Madsen. And in any event, not to belabor that issue. And, the new evidence, appellant did not have the new evidence at the trial. It had to be, I guess in a sense, he had an electronic device where the material was somewhere on that device, but did not have a means of accessing it. The electronic device had been damaged in some way. He had to have a company, go into it and retrieve that material. So it was not accessible in any kind of a meaningful sense. He didn't have any access to it whatsoever. And, I would say that the new evidence does tie into whether the evidence to grant the order for protection against appellant and deny appellants, that the new evidence is certainly relevant to where that evidence was sufficient. And regarding respondents' comments about domestic abuse months and the problem of domestic abuse, I certainly don't, that domestic abuse isn't a serious problem, but a case has to be considered on its merits. We can't just say because it's domestic abuse months, because a lot of people are victims of domestic abuse, this person must be a domestic abuser, case closed and move on. Everything has to be looked at in its own individual merits. Just because labels like domestic abuse or victim are thrown around, that can't be the end of the analysis. I'm concerned about that. I think that may have been an issue at the trial court level as well. A rush to judgment, for lack of a better word, looking at a serious problem, domestic abuse, and assuming that this case fit that analysis without, digging deeper into it. And as well as comments that appellant's order for protection was retaliatory. That's not found anywhere, certainly the court dismissed appellant's motion. The court did not say that his order of protection was retaliatory in some way. And again, that language has no place here. And every case needs to be looked at on its merits. One that does not have a more credible case simply because they got to the courthouse first. It's not a race. That's not how it should be looked at. And regarding the parenting time issues, to limit one's contact with their children, to only supervise, that's an extreme remedy. That's done with very few people. It's called for in some cases, but it is a high standard. It's not something that we do routinely or lightly. And the trial court did not make findings that appellant was somehow a danger to the children. Just because there's a finding that abuse has happened against a party does not automatically mean that one's parenting time is supervised. In most cases with orders of protection, parenting time isn't supervised. So there was not an appropriate finding that he was somehow a danger that parenting time should be supervised. And we certainly don't argue that the issue of language communication was certainly argued at the district court. I have no doubt there. It was argued extensively. But
Mr. Shah, can I just take you back to your last point there? Is there a statutory requirement that before a district court can limit parenting time, it has to find that there is a danger to the children, or can the district court limit parenting time based on some other kind of finding, as was made here?
Oh, Your Honor, thank you. Very good question. Certainly the statute, the parenting time statutes, and you know, in 518 and the related paternity statute, I think do refer to endangerment. There are cases where parenting time can be restricted without endangerment, but I think that those standards were not met here.
What about under the OFP statute?
Well, certainly the OFP statute does give authority to restrict parenting time, but I do not think the appropriate findings were made here that the children would somehow be endangered or their welfare threatened. Yeah, if appellant were allowed to have unsupervised parenting time with them. Thank you, Your Honor. I see that my time has run up. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you both very much. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.